Sometimes there's a bit of a queue for it, though since we get doodly for mobile reception out here, and you're looking at the only landline on the island. That's right, we got it all. Only food, only bed, only phone. And he leaned back and laughed, long and loud. The only phone on the island. I looked over at it. It was the kind that had a door you could pull shut for privacy, like the ones you see in old movies, and realized with dawning horror that this was the Grecian orgy. This was the raging frat party I'd been connected to when I called the island a few weeks ago. This was the piss hole. Kev handed my dad the keys to our rooms. "Any questions?" he said. "You know where to find me." "I have a question," I said. "What's a piss? I mean, a priest hole?" The men at the bar burst into laughter.
"Why, it's a hole for priests, of course," one said,
which made the rest of them laugh even harder. Kev walked over to an uneven patch of floorboards next to the fireplace where a mangy dog lay sleeping.
"Right here," he said, tapping what appeared to be a door in the floor with his shoe. "Ages ago, when just being a Catholic could get you hung from a tree, clergy folk came here seeking refuge. If Queen Elizabeth's crew of thugs come chasing after, we hid whoever needed hiding in snug little spots like this, priest holes."
It struck me the way he said, "we," as if he'd known those long-dead islanders personally.
"Snug indeed," one of the drinkers said. "But they were warm as toast and tight as drums down there."
"I'd take warm and snug to strung up by priest killers any day," said another.
"Hear, hear,"
the first man said.
"Took Cairn home. May she always be our rock of refuge." "Took Cairn home,"
they chorused and raised their glasses together. Jet-lagged and exhausted, we went to sleep early. Or rather, we went to our beds and lay in them with pillows covering our heads to block out the thumping cacophony that issued through the floorboards, which grew so loud that at one point I thought surely the revelers had invaded my room. Then the clock must have struck 10, because all at once the buzzing generators outside sputtered and died, as did the music from downstairs and the streetlight that had been shining through my window. Suddenly, I was cocooned in silent, blissful darkness, with only the whisper of distant waves to remind me where I was. For the first time in months, I fell into a deep, nightmare-free slumber. I dreamed instead about my grandfather as a boy, about his first night here, a stranger in a strange land, under a strange roof, owing his life to people who spoke a strange tongue. When I awoke, sun streaming through my window, I realized it wasn't just my grandfather's life that Miss Peregrine had saved, but mine, too, and my father's. Today, with any luck, I would finally get to thank her. I went downstairs to find my dad already bellied up to a table, slurping coffee and polishing his fancy binoculars. Just as I sat down, Kev appeared bearing two plates loaded with mystery meat and fried toast.
"I didn't know you could fry toast," I remarked,
to which Kev replied that there wasn't a food he was aware of that couldn't be improved by frying. Over breakfast, Dad and I discussed our plan for the day. It was to be a kind of scout, to familiarize ourselves with the island. We'd scope out my dad's bird-watching spots first, and then find the children's home. I scarfed my food, anxious to get started. Well fortified with grease, we left the pub and walked through town, dodging tractors and shouting to each other over the din of generators until the streets gave way to fields and the noise faded behind us. It was a crisp and blustery day, the sun hiding behind giant cloud banks only to burst out moments later and dapple the hills with spectacular rays of light, and I felt energized and hopeful. We were heading for a rocky beach where my dad had spotted a bunch of birds from the ferry.
I wasn't sure how we would reach it, though. The island was slightly bowl-shaped, with hills that climbed toward its edges only to drop off at precarious seaside cliffs. But at this particular spot, the edge had been rounded off, and a path led down to a minor spit of sand along the water. We picked our way down to the beach, where what seemed to be an entire civilization of birds were flapping and screeching and fishing in tide pools. I watched my father's eyes widen. "Fascinating," he muttered, scraping at some petrified guano with the stubby end of his pen. "I'm going to need some time here. Is that all right?" I'd seen this look on his face before, and I knew exactly what "some time" meant. Hours and hours. "Then I'll go find the house by myself," I said. "Not alone, you aren't. You promised." "Then I'll find a person who can take me." "Who?" "Kev will know someone." My dad looked out to sea, where a big rusted lighthouse jutted up from a pile of rocks.
"You know what the answer would be if your mom were here," he said.
My parents had differing theories about how much parenting I required. Mom was the enforcer, always hovering, but Dad hung back a little. He thought it was important that I make my own mistakes now and then. Also, letting me go would free him to play with guano all day.
"Okay," he said, "but make sure you leave me the number of whoever you go with."
"Dad, nobody here has phones." He sighed.
"Right. Well, as long as they're reliable."
Kev was out running an errand, and because asking one of his drunken regulars to chaperone me seemed like a bad idea, I went into the nearest shop to ask someone who was at least gainfully employed. The door read, "Fishmonger." I pushed it open to find myself cowering before a bearded giant in a blood-soaked apron. He left off decapitating fish to glare at me, dripping cleaver in hand, and I vowed never again to discriminate against the intoxicated.
"What the hell for?"
he growled when I told him where I wanted to go.
"Nothing over there but bog land and balmy weather."
I explained about my grandfather and the children's home. He frowned at me, then leaned over the counter to cast a doubtful glance at my shoes.
"I suppose Dylan ain't too busy to take you,"
he said, pointing his cleaver at a kid about my age who was arranging fish in a freezer case.
"But you'll be wanting proper footwear. Wouldn't do to let you go in them trainers. Mud'll suck 'em right off."
"Really?" I said. "Are you sure?"
"Dylan, fetch our man here a pair of Wellingtons."
The kid groaned and made a big show of slowly closing the freezer case and cleaning his hands before slouching over to a wall of shelves packed with dry goods.
"Just so happens we've got some good sturdy boots on offer," the fishmonger said. "Buy one, get none free."
He burst out laughing and slammed his cleaver on a salmon, its head shooting across the blood-slick counter to land perfectly in a little guillotine bucket. I fished the emergency money Dad had given me from my pocket, figuring that a little extortion was a small price to pay to find the woman I'd crossed the Atlantic to meet. I left the shop wearing a pair of rubber boots so large my sneakers fit inside, and so heavy it was difficult to keep up with my begrudging guide. "So, do you go to school on the island?" I asked Dylan, scurrying to catch up. I was genuinely curious. What was living here like for someone my age? He muttered the name of a town on the mainland. "What is that, an hour each way by ferry?"
"Yup."
And that was it. He responded to further attempts at conversation with even fewer syllables, which is to say, none. So finally, I just gave up and followed him. On the way out of town, we ran into one of his friends, an older boy wearing a blinding yellow tracksuit and fake gold chains. He couldn't have looked more out of place on Cairnholm if he'd been dressed like an astronaut. He gave Dylan a fist bump and introduced himself as Worm.
"Worm? It's his stage name," Dylan explained.
We're the sickest rapping duo in Wales,
Worm said.
I'm MC Worm, and this is the Sturgeon Surgeon, a.k.a. MC Dirty Dylan, a.k.a. MC Dirty Business, Carnholme's number one beatboxer. Wanna show this yank how we do it, Dirty D?
Dylan looked annoyed.
Now,
drop some next level beats, son.
Dylan rolled his eyes, but did as he was asked. At first, I thought he was choking on his tongue, except there was a rhythm to his sputtering coughs.
Puh-puh-cha, puh-puh-puh-cha,
over which Worm began to rap.
I likes to get wrecked up and down at the priest hole. Your dad's always there 'cause he's on the dole. My rhymes is tight, yet I make it look easy. Dylan's beats are hot like chicken Jalfrezi.
Dylan stopped.
That don't even make sense, he said. And it's your dad who's on the dole.
Oh, shit! Dirty D, let the beat drop!
Worm started beatboxing while doing a passable robot, his sneakers twisting holes in the gravel.
Take the mic, D!
Dylan seemed embarrassed, but let the rhymes fly anyway.
I met a tight bird and her name was Sharon. She was keen on my tracksuit and the trainers I was wearing. I showed her the time like Doctor Who. I thunk up this rhyme while I was in the loo.
Worm shook his head.
The loo? I wasn't ready.
They turned to me and asked what I thought. Considering that they didn't even like each other's rapping, I wasn't sure what to say.
I guess I'm more into music with, like, singing and guitars and stuff.
Worm dismissed me with a wave of his hand.
He wouldn't know a dope rhyme if it bit him in the bollocks, he muttered.
Dylan laughed, and they exchanged a series of complex, multi-stage handshake fist bump high fives.
Can we go now? I said.
They grumbled and dawdled a while longer, but pretty soon we were on our way, this time with Worm tagging along. I took up the rear, trying to figure out what I would say to Miss Peregrine when I met her. I was expecting to be introduced to a proper Welsh lady and sip tea in the parlor and make polite small talk until the time seemed right to break the bad news. I'm Abraham Portman's grandson, I would say. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but he's been taken from us. Then, once she'd finished quietly dabbing away tears, I would ply her with questions. I followed Dylan and Worm along a path that wound through pastures of grazing sheep before a lung-busting ascent up a ridge. At the top hovered an embankment of rolling, snaking fog so dense it was like stepping into another world. It was truly biblical. A fog I could imagine God, in one of his lesser wraths, cursing the Egyptians with. As we descended the other side, it only seemed to thicken. The sun faded to a pale white bloom. Moisture clung to everything, beating on my skin and dampening my clothes. The temperature dropped. I lost Worm and Dylan for a moment, and then the path flattened, and I came upon them just standing, waiting for me.
Yank boy, Dylan called. This way.
I followed obediently. We abandoned the path to plow through a field of marshy grass. Sheep stared at us with big, leaky eyes, their wool soggy and tails drooping. A small house appeared out of the mist. It was all boarded up.
You sure this is it? I said. It looks empty.
Empty? No way. There's loads of shit in there,
Worm replied.
Go on, Dylan said. Have a look.
I had a feeling it was a trick, but stepped up to the door and knocked anyway. It was unlatched and opened a little at my touch. It was too dark to see inside, so I took a step through and, to my surprise, down into what looked like a dirt floor, but I quickly realized was in fact a shin-deep ocean of excrement. This tenantless hovel, so innocent looking from the outside, was really a makeshift sheep stable. Quite literally,
a shithole.
Oh my God,
I squealed in disgust. Peals of laughter exploded from outside. I stumbled backward through the door before the smell could knock me unconscious and found the boys doubled over, holding their stomachs.
You guys are assholes, I said, stomping the muck off my boots.
Why? Said Worm. We told you it was full of shit.
I got in Dylan's face. Are you going to show me the house or not?
He's serious, said Worm, wiping tears from his eyes.
Of course I'm serious.
Dylan's smile faded.
I thought you were taking a piss, mate.
Taking a what?
Joking like.
Well, I wasn't.
The boys exchanged an uneasy look. Dylan whispered something to Worm. Worm whispered something back. Finally, Dylan turned and pointed up the path.
If you really want to see it, he said, keep going past the bog and through the woods. It's a big old place. You can't miss it.
What the hell? You're supposed to go with me.
Worm looked away and said,
this is as far as we go.
Why?
It just is.
And they turned and began to trudge back the way we'd come, receding into the fog. I weighed my options. I could tuck tail and follow my tormentors back to town, or I could go ahead alone and lie to Dad about it. After 4 seconds of intense deliberation, I was on my way. A vast lunar bog stretched away into the mist from either side of the path. Just brown grass and tea-colored water as far as I could see, featureless, but for the occasional mound of piled-up stones. It ended abruptly at a forest of skeletal trees, branches spindling up like the tips of wet paintbrushes, and for a while, the path became so lost beneath fallen trunks and carpets of ivy that navigating it was a matter of faith. I wondered how an elderly person like Miss Peregrine would ever be able to negotiate such an obstacle course. She must get deliveries, I thought, though the path looked like it hadn't seen a footprint in months, if not years. I scrambled over a giant trunk slick with moss, and the path took a sharp turn. The trees parted like a curtain, and suddenly, there it was, cloaked in fog, looming atop a weed-choked hill. The house. I understood at once why the boys had refused to come. My grandfather had described it 100 times, but in his stories, the house was always a bright, happy place, big and rambling, yes, but full of light and laughter. What stood before me now was no refuge for monsters, but a monster itself, staring down from its perch on the hill with vacant hunger. Trees burst forth from broken windows, and skins of scabrous vine gnawed at the walls like antibodies attacking a virus, as if nature itself had waged war against it. But the house seemed unkillable, resolutely upright despite the wrongness of its angles and the jagged teeth of sky visible through sections of collapsed roof. I tried to convince myself that it was possible someone could still live there, run down as it was. Such things weren't unheard of where I came from, a falling down wreck on the edge of town, curtains permanently drawn that would turn out to have been home to some ancient recluse who'd been surviving on ramen and toenail clippings since time immemorial, though no one realizes it until a property appraiser or an overly ambitious census taker barges in to find the poor soul returning to dust in a lazy boy. People get too old to care for a place. Their family writes them off for one reason or another. It's sad, but it happens, which meant, like it or not, that I was going to have to knock. I gathered what scrawny courage I had and waded through waist-high weeds to the porch, all broken tile and rotting wood, to peek through a cracked window. All I could make out through the smeared glass were the outlines of furniture, so I knocked on the door and stood back to wait in the eerie silence, tracing the shape of Miss Peregrine's letter in my pocket. I'd taken it along in case I needed to prove who I was, but as a minute ticked by, then two, it seemed less and less likely that I would need it. Climbing down into the yard, I circled the house looking for another way in, taking the measure of the place, but it seemed almost without measure, as though with every corner I turned, the house sprouted new balconies.